So before I launch into this podcast episode, which features Patricia Rosema and Robert Forster, I just want to say that I recorded this a number of years ago, and sadly and tragically, this past year, 2019, Robert Forster passed away. And so keep that in mind when you're listening to it. I'm going to try and make some edits. And I'm actually going to be making a full episode on Robert, but I feel as though the content relating to a mentorship is really important and valid. And I think you'll appreciate how it fits into that topic. So, without further ado, here's the episode.
This is Film Survival, the podcast. I'm Eva Zimson. What is this podcast about? It's about how to survive and thrive in a creative career. It's about what it takes to actually make it in this industry. It's the war stories. It's filmmakers talking about their careers and how they got where they are. It's about pounding the pavement and learning to love that process. In this episode, you'll see what it takes to forge a long-lasting and fruitful relationship with a mentor. And sometimes, if you're lucky, a friendship blossoms. In the film industry, having a mentor is really one of the most important things you need to do. So people always ask me, how do you get a mentor? And they almost think it's like the mentor will suddenly come to them and solve all of their needs and give them all of this advice, and that's sort of how it works. And I learned that you actually have to find a mentor, and it has to be a mutually beneficial relationship. So what happened with me was I was in my undergrad, and I went up to my professor after watching this filmmaker's film, Patricia Rosema, who made a film called I've Heard the Mermaids Singing, and I just loved the film. And I said, I want her to be my mentor. How do I find her? And he said, well, have you seen her other films? And I said, no. And he said, well, that's probably the first thing you need to do is you need to watch all of her films, and then you need to read up on her. Like, what do you know about her? And I said, well, nothing. I just watched this film. I really like her. I want her to be my mentor. And he said, no, you need to know everything about her before you approach her. So I went and did that. I actually ended up doing an independent study course on her. So I wrote an essay. I read tons of previous interviews on her, watched all of her films, and equally loved them. And then I actually found out she was speaking at the public library. So I went and heard her talk and actually recorded it. Then I felt like I could actually approach her. And I said, I'm writing this essay about you at my university. Would you be willing to take an interview? And she said, follow up with my assistant. So I did, and I ended up getting an interview with her. I brought her some Dutch cookies because I knew she was Dutch. And her assistant, I brought Belgian chocolates. I didn't know it didn't have anything to do with Belgium, but they were just nice chocolates. And I did that, and that was sort of one of my first lessons in that it's a good thing to bring a gift. It's good to come bearing a gift when you want something. And I at this point, I just wanted an interview. She was so gracious, and I think she was impressed with how much I knew about her and the kinds of questions I was asking, because I wasn't asking questions that were easily found in the previous, work written about her. And we got into more in-depth subjects. I think that helped to solidify a relationship with her. What happened was the 1 hour meeting turned into a 2 hour meeting, and it ended up with her saying, please stay in touch. And so I ended up sending her my essay, and I ended up each year at around Christmas time, I would send her a gift. I find it very important to really take the time to follow up with the person who gives you their time the relationship with Patricia was an informal mentorship, because each year I would check in with her, and sometimes when I would say I have something for you, she would invite me over and we would have a little chat. And I remember when I came back from doing my master's in England, and I had made a film about Lars von Trier, and I now had a feature film written that I was wanting to shop around and get a Canadian producer on board. And I mentioned this to her, and she said, you know, I'm happy to help you. Why don't we meet for lunch? And so we did, and she ended up putting a call in to almost every big producer in Toronto for me, and trying to basically get meetings for me for this feature film, because, you know, Lars's company was interested. And this basically is what a mentor does. If long enough you stay in touch, they will one day, you know, really come through for you. And she also wrote a reference letter for me for a major film school. So, and I did not really almost have to ask her this. She offered this. And that's ideally how you want a mentorship to be. And I offered to help her with anything always, but she didn't even want me to assist her because she thought I should be making films and not being her, you know, secretary / assistant. That was one example. Another example of a mentorship, and I really almost call it friendships, is one with Robert Forster. I ended up getting this job on the production called Lake Boat, written by David Mamet, and Joe Mantegna was directing. I was on an independent film as a first AD / casting director / a lot of other things. And my name got passed to some other producer. And lo and behold, I got a call to read lines opposite Jack Wallace, who is known for The Bear, the film. And he ended up being this cool actor who needed me to just read lines to just practice a bit. And he would take me out to gourmet meals in Yorkville, and I would read lines. And I think I was making $30 an hour, and as I was 18 years old, and it was the sweetest gig of all time. And then one day I got to go on set, and I was meeting all these cool people, and there was Robert Forster eating lunch at the table with the crew and cast. And after lunch, I ended up walking off with Robert Forster, and we sat down, and I kind of told him my life story a little bit. And I think that he suddenly took interest. He thought, you know, this is kind of a different person. And we kept in touch. And at the time, I think he was just thought I was interesting and pleasant to have around, and this eager film girl. And he ended up even coming to my university and speaking. It was very kind of him. And then in my second year, I made this film called Mama and Papa about my parents and how they met on a train. And I sent it to him. One day, out of the blue, I, you know, get a beep on the phone, and I beep over, and it's Robert Forster. And, you know, he says, "Eva, this is Robert Forster from Los Angeles. And I watched your film, and I think it's great. And I want you to make a film and with me in it before I die." I thought that was so cool. And this was all because I took the time to send a VHS tape of my film to Robert Forster. And next time he was in town, we met up, and he took me to dinner. And I remember then he got sick, and I ended up putting this huge care package together of like Buckley's mixture and stuff like that. And to this day, he does not forget that I did that, because he was alone in town and had no one, and he got this little care package. And we just kept staying in touch, and it turned into a friendship. And now, you know, we kind of are just friends. And it's one of those things that you have to really maintain those relationships. You have to keep in touch. And it should also be, again, mutually beneficial, where there's got to be a benefit for the other person sort of helping you and advising you. And sometimes that's just you really almost being a great listener to their stories, because they want to mentor somebody. And if you have a great interest in their work and you show that you've done your research, that's often all it takes. You know, I've been friends with Robert Forster for, I think it's over 14 years or something. And the key to, you know, maintaining a relationship with a mentor is for you to be the proactive one because, you know, you're the mentee. So anytime I would go to LA, I would obviously make an effort to visit him around his schedule and all of that. And I would bring presents for him and his daughter, etc. And I remember the first time that I met him in LA, and I was in LA to check out film schools, and I met him at this the Silver Spoon, which is this hub of celebrities having brunch. And at the time, you know, he was actually, he had a specific spot on the edge of the Silver Spoon, and Quentin Tarantino was supposed to come that day. And I was just, you know, out of my mind excited because I thought, oh my God, I might be having an omelet with Quentin Tarantino. This is insane. Anyway, but Quentin didn't show up, but that was cool anyway. And I ended up bringing my camera. I tend to bring my camera to anything I go to at any point, especially with these kind of situations. So, you know, you never know what presents itself. And we ended up talking a lot. Robert Forster has this, you know, menu of stories that he gives. And I talked about how I brought him to my university when I first met him in Toronto. But again, he was, you know, just he just breaks out into a story at any given moment. So I was like, well, maybe I should just film you right now. And he's like, sure, he's an actor. So he's kind of always on, and put out the camera. Unfortunately, I had a big spoon appropriate for the Silver Spoon in the foreground. But that was the first time I decided to film Robert Forster. But I knew that I wanted to go back to that at some point. So fast forward, I'd been, you know, keeping in touch with him for a long time. We even texted one time when he was at the Oscars. I was like, I was watching from my couch and he was there. And it's kind of a little cool back and forth banter that way. And most recently, I went to L.A. and we decided we would actually film this again a little bit better. And we went up into the Hollywood Hills and where he likes to go for hikes, and it was quiet and we had LA in the background. And, you know, he told me his stories again, and I'm going to actually share some clips from that with you. Basically, Robert Forster teaches you about life through his stories as working as an actor, working in a creative industry. So let's have a listen. What is probably the best advice you would give to a, you know, an emerging director? What's the most important thing you got to do when you're directing an actor?
Boy, I think there's a lot of different things that you must figure out to do. I think that actors are very different. I worked for a director who was very, very helpful. He had a feeling for, he wrote the script, he had a feeling for a lot of the meanings he wanted to make happen in a short amount of visual space. And so he wanted the actors to articulate the meanings of his lines in ways that he had heard them when he wrote them and was now giving you help and instructing you to deliver what he heard in his ear. And 2 weeks ago, I worked for a director who had the virtue of who wrote it and who heard all those words, and it was very well written. They're both detective thrillers. One, the for the Spanish, it's called Automata, and is set in the future, a dreary future. Future which will require a lot of CGI and robots and an earthscape that is that is not green and trees, that's a desert, and they created a lot of that. This other director I worked for just 2 weeks ago, it was one of the most interesting projects I've ever done. Just to describe it, this guy wrote five acts. A movie of five acts of 20 minutes each. That's 20, 40, 60. It's an hour and 40 minutes. That's the length of a decent movie. Each one of these acts, like Hitchcock's Rope, is shot in one continuous take. And so this is this guy's Dennis Houck. He decided he was going to write a very well-written detective genre script and avoided an awful lot of the cliches. Most of those that type relies on the cliches. This was real good. And he also And he also is putting these five acts not in the order in which they occur, but in the order in which they will be most interestingly received by the audience. So he's already given us a couple of things to work with, but the most interesting for an actor is the fact that the act that I shot of about 20 or 21 minutes in length, it varied each time we shot it, was something that the actors rehearsed for 2 days, and then they shot it with a Steadicam and a rickshaw and an estate up in the hills where you get interiors and answering the door, and then you come out to the pool area, and there's killings in these shot in my shot, and in so for 2 days we rehearsed this, and the third day we shot it. There are a lot of moving parts. The camera is moving. You're trying to catch the action and the reactions. You're trying to catch the things that the audience needs to see in order to make this thing an interesting one-take scene. And this director had the virtue of giving very little advice. So over a period of 2 days, the actors worked and worked. And I tell you this, and it's a 20-minute scene. It's like doing a little play. You got a lot of cues and a lot of things that you got to do that you got to make happen. I and the guy that I was sitting at the outside table with, we didn't move for the whole shot, but the two women moved, and the detective. Of course, this is the detective story. He arrives, and the woman of the house brings him out to the pool area where he confronts me with evidence, and so. This guy didn't have much to say at all, but he let the actors, and every once in a while, and after we had shot it on the third day, we had shot it maybe six times. We didn't have much light. We didn't have much time. We couldn't shoot it many more times. It really, there wasn't a decent take among them. There were fumbles. There was this. There was that. We hadn't had a great take. And right near the end, he comes over and he says, let's pick it up a little. And I was tired. It was a hot day outside. We're working day in and day, and we got our squibs, and we've got to reset these squibs and the blood and all that every single shot, change of wardrobe, clean up the blood, start again. It was time consuming to set these shots up. He just came over and said, pick it up a little. It stimulated me, it stimulated everybody to regroup and to rethink our intentions and to just shave off a minute's worth of air out of this. It was the very, very best piece of direction the guy could have given. It gave the actors not something specific, do this, do that, something, but some general thing that gave them and reminded them of their purpose and their goal, which was to make a shot that an audience could watch. He didn't have much to say except that. And I thought to myself, at a key moment, this is a perfect piece of direction. It doesn't hurt anybody, and it makes everybody imagine, yes, I can do this thing. Pick it up just a little. And it helped, and we got a great shot. Then the sun came out the first time all day long. The sun is now real low. It's shining low on the geography out there, Los Angeles in the background, and we give it one more shot, and wow, what a thriller. It was two good shots in a row, and the second shot when the sun came out might have been our best of the day, and there you go. You get lucky sometimes. You go from zero, where you start with a piece of material that you've never seen before, and try to get to a 10 before you finish shooting it. And you try each shot to get it better and better and more refined. And whammo, we got the best shot that we had done. Pick it up a little. Knowing what you mean and meaning it when you say it, one of the simples of what you do as an actor. And I remind people that sounds like a very big assortment of things and a hard task, delivering a stroke which advantages everybody's needs at once, but it is not that hard to keep other people's needs in mind and to deliver them. What are you saving it for, Bob? And I believe that it is possible in life, in practically every environment, to give others the best of it. And to figure out what their needs are on a little constantly changing basis and deliver the best you can. And when you do that, there is a reward. I always mention to people that you get when you deliver your excellent best to right now, the reward of satisfaction. This is huge. The reward of self-respect. These are huge components of the good life, if you happen to be looking for the good life. I learned three really important things. I learned that the word respect has polar opposite meanings. At the one end of the meaning of the word is the thing that people give you if they're afraid of you, if you got a hammer over their head. They call that respect. At the extreme opposite end of the meaning of the same word is the thing that people give you when they're not afraid of you, when they love you, and when they want to see you succeed and give you a little space to operate and hope you do good. They call that respect. I realized that this is what passes for respect in Hollywood. Who's got the hammer? And number three, I said to myself, boy, if you ever get any of that respect, I hope it comes from that end of the scheme. At least you don't have to worry about getting stabbed in the back by that kind of respect. I realized a lot of things, and over the years I have been a parent, and I've been trying to explain to my children, you know, what you finally discover about being alive and existence and purpose and all of that. And I remind my children that life is short, 50, 75 seasons, maybe 100. That life is an arc. First you're born and you can't take care of yourself. You got to rely on your parents. And then for a while, you've got to rely on yourself. And then for most of your life, you really have to take care of others until the very end, when you can no longer take care of yourself and have to rely on the ones you've parented. You better do a good job, Bob. I realize that that arc of life is segmented into a lot of now moments. Moments to which you can deliver your excellent best or less if you choose. But if you do deliver your excellent best to any one of those moments, almost an infinite number of those in a lifetime, almost an infinite number of those in a day, moments to which you can deliver your excellent best or less. But when you do deliver your excellent best, you get the reward of self-respect.
I just want to pause quickly before I play the summary of this podcast on how to get a mentor. Listening to Robert again after all this time, and even this edit, which I haven't touched since the 5 years where we recorded it, it's just so telling and poignant of him to talk about life and his advice about, you know, how to go about it. It's how most of his talks would end. They would end in some kind of really profound life advice, which of course now that he has passed is all the more meaningful. So just wanted to say that it's such a great loss. And I will produce a podcast dedicated to him alone, but I'm glad I could include him with the mentorship episode because he was such a meaningful mentor to me.
There are some really important steps to getting a mentor, and the first is that you must research everything they have ever done. So you need to watch all of their films, including their first films. So you should try and find their short films from film school if you can at all. Now it's much easier with the internet. You can probably find it online. That's the first thing. Number two, so make sure you also watch their first film and their most recent work. And that might even be a TV show or something like that. So make sure you watch the full gamut. At that point, that's when you have the right to contact them. And believe it or not, it's actually rather easy to find them. I've actually guessed people's email addresses. You just do a few combinations of their name and their company, .com, .ca, and I ended up getting through to very high-level people doing that. You can probably find an email address of somebody who knows them, because once you do enough research on them, you'll know who works with them. And sometimes if it's a director, it's much easier to contact a producer, because producers often have their email addresses on LinkedIn, etc. They do check those. So whatever means necessary, and you write a little letter. And the letter, you know, if you're, let's say, an emerging, like a filmmaker or a student, you could say, you know, hi, so-and-so, I am a great fan of your work. I've watched everything you have done. I particularly admire XYZ about, and then that's when you should mention one of their first works, where they're going to think, whoa, wait a minute, this person found this film. How did this person even find this film? they must be my stalker. And then you talk about, and I also really appreciated, you know, ABC about this work. And that's when you mentioned their most recent work. And what you appreciate and what you say says more obviously about you than it does about them. So you need to be intelligent here and you need to be insightful to say something that you think they will appreciate, that you appreciate. And that's very important, because a mentor wants to know that you took the time and that you understand them and that you're worth investing in. So that's the second step. You write that. And then you say, I would be honored if you would have 10 minutes for a coffee meeting, or 15 minutes, something like that. I mean, they think 10 minutes is too crazy. So probably 15-minute coffee meeting at your convenience. I would greatly appreciate asking you 5 questions about getting into the industry in this area, or something like that. And then you leave your contact info. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, I think people will get back to you on that. The real question is whether they have the time. And so you're going to have to be very flexible. Like, I've had to wait half a year to get a meeting with somebody. You have to be very patient. That's really the sure bet way of getting to somebody. And the other way is also, you know, once you know a lot about a person, you might end up talking to somebody that knows them at some other event. So perhaps an editor who knows that director, etc. I've also found when you kind of put it out in the universe and you're kind of a mini obsess about somebody and you watch enough of their work, you come across their path or they come across your path. And you actually need to do that for a lot of mentors. I recommend doing that for 10 possible mentors. And if you're Canadian, you're in Canada, I say do it for 7 Canadians and maybe 3 American. Actually, for me, Stanley Kubrick is a mentor of mine, and I know he's dead. So I actually think it's valid to have a mentor who might not even be accessible at all, but you can still do that exercise and think of the questions you would ask them. And they should obviously be very intelligent and insightful, so that when you ask those questions, they're right away going to realize what a smart person you are and how they want to help someone like you. The other reason to have this prepared long in advance and try to actually even rehearse it is that one day you might be in Cannes in an elevator and in walks George Lucas, and now's your one and only chance to say something, and you better have it. That's what often these opportunities end up being like you will see somebody very briefly, quickly, and you have to deliver. On top of that, as I mentioned, you know, some of these people really have no reason to be in touch with you. They have so many things to do. They're very busy. Why should they care about you? And the answer is, you should be a pleasure to be around. You should actually be a person that they want to help because it feels good. So when you're being mentored, you have to listen, because people like to give advice. They like to sometimes hear themselves talk. But actually, they also, above everything, have been mentored by other people, and they want to pass that on. So if you're the lucky one that they're choosing to help, you should really show your appreciation. And I kind of have become known for doing weird little thank you gifts or little tokens of appreciation. One thing I did for Lars von Trier, after I had, you know, secured an interview with him, I ended up going back to Canada, and I spent more on a gift for them than I did for my family that year. What I did was I had scarves embroidered with their names and a maple leaf for each. So Lars got a little head scarf that he likes to wear. He likes to wear bandanas around his neck, kind of like a cowboy. And so I had Lars and the Canadian maple leaf on that one. And then Peter Albeck Jensen and the assistant Thomas Schindel got fleece scarves with their names embroidered and a maple leaf. And I ended up going to a conference in Berlin. And it was a conference that was for the biggest moguls in Europe. And Peter Albeck Jensen was sitting on the panel at the front. He looks down at me. Now, I should say that I ended up getting into this conference because I volunteered to film it. And it was, I think the tickets were £800. And so I was sitting there filming, and he looks down and he's like, "Hey, you." And they all look at me and they're like, "How do you know the camera girl?" And then he says, "Come and meet me at lunch." So I did. And we walk to the coat room, and we go to the coat room, and he gets out his jacket and he pulls out the scarf that I had sent them with his name embroidered and the maple leaf. And then he said to me, "You know, you should come and talk to me at the end of the festival. The next few days I'm too busy to talk to you. That's when I'm making the next few millions for the company. But at the end, I'll have time for you. So come by." So I did. And it was a blessing, because before, like, those days that were leading up to that, I was horribly pitching my project and learning each time with each pitch, you know, what to cut and how to make the pitch better. And by the time it rolled around to talk to Peter, I actually perfected my pitch, and we sat down and I told him my story, and he said, "That sounds like a great film, and please hold," you know, and he picked up his weird satellite, weird looking phone, and opened it and called his producer in Denmark and said, "You know, I have this filmmaker here, we should read her script." And anyway, the rest is history. I ended up, they wanted to make my film, and we ended up having a follow-up meeting in Cannes. But this was all because of my scarves. So this had to do with the whole operation, you know, the film that I made, but also the follow-up was key. And that turned into a long-term connection, where every festival I would often bring him cigars. But he knows me, you know, he can pick me out of a crowd, and he remembers me and what I did. And that's worth something. And so they were always open to hearing my pitches, even though we didn't make that film at the time. So that's the end of the show. I want to thank you for listening. And on the next episode of Film Survival, we will talk about the 10-year plan, my favorite.